Good morning, everyone. Well, I imagine if you looked at the program, do we call them programs? Bulletins? Program and bullet. I have three quotes on there. One from the Buddha, one from Friedrich Nietzsche, and one from Wile E. Coyote. Which I suppose you're wondering how I'm going to knit that together. It sounds like the beginning of a bad joke, doesn't it? You know, the Buddha, Nietzsche, and Coyote walk into a bar. So this should be entertaining, to say the least. And thanks for all coming on Memorial Day weekend. Memorial Day weekend is kind of an interesting holiday, isn't it? It's traditionally supposed to be a day of remembrance of those who have sacrificed in the service of their country. And so for a number of people, maybe that entails a trip to the cemetery. I know when we were kids, we'd go visit the cemetery and clean off the graves, kind of an Americanized version of Obon. For kids, really, though, it kind of signals maybe the end of the school year. Remember that? That all the other days after Memorial Day were just kind of fluff. For the fashion conscious, it represents when you could start wearing white, something I was not really aware of. For anyone living in Minnesota, it marks the beginning of something far more important, the beginning of construction season. So, and by extension, this is the beginning of cabin season, right, mass exodus, which is why I really didn't expect to see so many people today. I thought everyone would be maybe up north. So it marks the beginning of the cabin season, the beginning of home construction, remodeling, home improvement season. So believe it or not, that's what I'm actually talking about, which is what's on here, house building. And in a way, this is a follow-up to my talk last December when I talked about home leaving. So it seemed to be perhaps a good idea to maybe talk a little bit about what we're actually leaving when we talk about home leaving in Buddhism. So there's a lot of talk about home leaving and houses in Buddhism. So much so, in fact, you would think that Buddhism would have special appeal for contractors and real estate agents. So, and you think about it, you know, the Buddha's life starts, you know, the story of his life, you know, starts kind of in this palace, which, you know, he undertakes a spiritual journey where he has several excursions, you know, away from the palace, where he encounters, you know, sickness, old age, death. In a wandering mendicant, you have the very dramatic episode where he leaves his home. Some stories have him vaulting over the palace walls on horseback. Very dramatic. You have, upon his enlightenment, the Buddha says, "House builder, you have been seen. You will not build this house again." And in the Pali Canon, you have lots of parables and mentions of houses. You have the story of the burning house where the father is outside trying to lure his kids out of a burning house. I won't go into what that parable is. It sounds kind of awful, I guess, but very dramatic. In fact, almost every thing that has to do with samsara, the world of suffering, as it were, has to do with houses in Buddhism. And usually takes place, all the stories usually take place in a house or a compound or a palace, either literally or metaphorically. And you think about it, all the major experiences of the Buddha's spiritual life take place out of doors. It's kind of interesting. You know, he's born out of doors. He has his first experience of deep meditation outside under a rose apple tree at the age of 12. He has his excursions outside the palace walls, which kind of set him upon the spiritual path. He leaves the house, his home, and embarks on a life of asceticism that eventually accumulates in his enlightenment, which is which happens under a tree outside. Eventually, his death is outside too. He spends his entire life away from home. All of his major spiritual things are all outside of a house. And you see this whole house business kind of carried out symbolically in much of Buddhism. You have the story of Milarepa, the Tibetan yogi, who embarks on his spiritual quest after intentionally destroying the house of his somewhat wicked aunt and uncle using black magic. And so his personal spiritual practice begins with his teacher telling him to, guess what, build a series of stone houses on different hilltops, tear them down and rebuild them. And in the Zen tradition, we have the grass hut, which we all know, the grass hut of Sherpa, from reciting the Song of the Grass or of Heritage in retreat sometimes. So in my last talk about home leaving, I suggested that in a way we're always leaving home, or our homes are always leaving us. Not only can we never step into the same river twice, we're not even the same person when we dip our toes in the water again. You know, so there's this constant change that we are immersed in. We're changing. Everything around us is changing. So home leaving happens anyway, whether we want to or not. The recognition and acceptance of the simple fact that we're always kind of leaving home is a fundamental principle in Buddhist teaching. So we might as well consciously participate in leaving home with equanimity, grace, lightness of being, and perhaps even on good days, some joy. But the truth of the matter is, we're not very comfortable with the nature of things as they are. So we look for some special place to which we can escape the nature of existence, where we can find some sort of permanent refuge, permanent happiness in things or states of being. And most importantly, some place where we can enjoy ourselves as permanently abiding as separate entities. According to the Buddhist teaching, no such place exists. No such state of being exists. So to believe otherwise is essentially magical thinking and is one of the most fundamental of our delusions. But out of our delusion, we nevertheless try to create a place, an abode, a home, where the fundamental laws of reality, the fact that all things change, will somehow be magically suspended for me. The heck with the rest of you guys. You know. So this is house building in a Buddhist sense. The house in this sense is the self. Our thoughts, concepts, belief, and so forth are the furnishings. So there are many different rooms in this house of self, and each room is a cherished part of ourselves, perhaps tastefully furnished, but nonetheless part of this construction of ourself. So all of the thoughts, our ideas, our concepts of who we are, our concepts of what the world is, these are like the furnishing in the rooms. The rooms are painted, the walls are painted with emotion. They are hung with our memories. So this is the way our self is constructed. Bless you. So we go to great lengths to make ourselves comfortable in the houses that we build, and we'll spare no expense in time or energy in building them or maintaining them. It's our cozy little home. But this is a problem for us because ultimately it doesn't work. Our efforts, in fact, become a source of most of our suffering. So this is what I wish to talk about today, our exaggerated, ceaseless house building, and how in many ways it does not really serve us very well. It doesn't serve others, it doesn't serve society, it doesn't serve nature. And perhaps there might be another way that we can understand the self and thereby come to construct and utilize the shelter of a self in a more wholesome, less problematic, less exaggerated way. So building shelters for our bodies as well as consciousness, I think, is somewhat hardwired into us. We start doing it pretty early in life, playing around with the building of both literal and metaphoric shelters. Do you remember as a kid building forts? I don't know why there were always forts, but nonetheless, we build house, we play house. So I think this is kind of part of our evolutionary makeup. We're conditioned to build shelters. We build metaphoric shelters. I build a self. We do this, you know, through our imagination and play. We create imaginary worlds where we are the hero or heroine. You know, perhaps we still do that quite a bit. And now we have the added advantage of being able to create virtual realities using our amazing technology. So building a self comes naturally. And just like the building of a physical shelter for that houses our physical body, the building of a self is part of our evolution of human consciousness. We need a self, in other words. The tendency to create a self also seems to be hardwired into us. This is how we exist as an individual in the world. We do have to take care of ourselves as individuals. We have to feed ourselves, clothe ourselves, look after ourselves. So no doubt having a self to some degree serves an important purpose. And it's a great advantage to us and necessary for our survival and well-being. But for many of us, for most of us, for me, something goes wrong with the house building. And we forget what we're doing and why. Our house building gets out of control. For one thing, we become very, very attached to our house and all its furnishings, and all its rooms. We begin to hope and then eventually come to believe that the house of the self will last forever and everything in it will last forever. And perhaps more problematically, we begin to identify with the house that we build in our heads. We begin to identify with all its belongings. And we do so to a degree that becomes very unwholesome for us. It entraps us. What should be a simple shelter turns out to become a prison. And after all, the only difference between a house and a prison is that you can voluntarily leave one, not the other. So here's a story about a particular house, an actual physical house that I visited several years ago that I think would serve as a good metaphor for what I'm talking about. The building itself, the house itself, is interesting in its own right, although I'm using it here as a metaphor about the Buddhist teaching on the construction of the self and the great lengths that we will go to enhance it, to become preoccupied with it, and the vast amount of resources that we throw at the building and furnishing of this house of self, and how our misguided efforts eventually cause so much suffering for us. So about this time of year, in May, several years ago, I was doing a speaking engagement out in California, in Los Angeles, and afterwards Nancy and I traveled up the coast to San Francisco, and along the way we were going through San Jose, and we stopped to take a tour of the Winchester Mansion. Has anyone ever seen that? Has anyone been to the Winchester Mansion in San Jose? This was a house built by Sarah Winchester, who was the wife, the widow at that time, of William Wirt Winchester, of the Winchester's Repeating Arms Company, so the people that manufactured guns, basically. So she built this house over the course of 36 years. And I'm talking about building it continuously for 36 years. Round-the-clock construction. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year for 36 years. As you can imagine, this resulted in a somewhat interesting house. But that's nothing compared to the amount of time and continuous construction we spend in our own house itself, right? So I think myself is considerably more interesting and bizarre than this house was. So there's a lot of stories about why Sarah Winchester built the house she did. They vary a little bit in details, but they all tell of her struggle to deal with her suffering at the death of her only child, a daughter at a fairly young age, and her husband, who died tragically of tuberculosis. And she was overwhelmed by this grief and suffering. And the story is she moved from the East Coast to California, where she believed that as long as she continuously built this house and never stopped, that that would somehow protect her from suffering. Similarity? Coincidence with the whole Buddhist thing? So anyway, she was convinced, Sarah was convinced that she was cursed, and that somehow, as long as she was going to be continuously engaged in building this house, she would be protected from suffering. In a way, I guess we do this in so many ways. And Buddhism points this out many times about how we will attach ourselves to a task, to a thing, imaginary or otherwise, as a way of dealing with our suffering. I suppose every time we go to the fridge to eat when we're stressed, that's a way of trying to mitigate our suffering through something that perhaps doesn't really work, but we do it nonetheless. So this is a very exaggerated way of doing this. So with almost endless resources at her disposal, because she was a very wealthy woman, I think her income was $1,000 a day, which in those days, and this was like the latter part of the 19th century, so like 1886. She built this house from like, I think, 1886 to 1922. So she had this income, $1,000 a day, which is something like, you know, $40,000, you know, in today's terms. So she was able to do pretty much anything she wanted with those resources. And there was no master plan to this construction. So the results were very haphazard. The construction was very haphazard, and the results somewhat bizarre. There was miles, and I mean miles, of twisting halls and corridors, stairways to nothing. The stairs would just go up and disappear into a ceiling. Doors that would open into brick walls or empty space, which could be a problem when it was like two or three stories up. We really talk about a mindfulness practice. Which door is to the bathroom? Windows that just opened up the blank walls. There was secret passageways within the walls. Columns installed upside down. Ultimately, 500 to 600 rooms were built over the course of 36 years and were either remodeled, demolished, rebuilt, or just simply sealed over. So it's kind of a perfect metaphor for the construction of self. In fact, when I was walking through the house, I couldn't help but feel that this bizarre house with all its twisting corridors and weird rooms and doors into nowhere and staircases to nowhere, I thought, this is all strangely familiar. I was thinking, wow, this is a lot like the inside of my head. I don't know about you guys. So I thought, this is what my self would look like, my metaphoric self, if portrayed in Better Homes and Garden. So Sarah Winchester was, by all accounts, a woman of exquisite taste and wealth to indulge them. Her rooms contained furnishings and art that that was valued in the millions, even in her days. This was not the kind of house, in other words, that had, you know, 500 tacky lawn ornaments, you know, on the front lawn, you know, or paintings of Elvis or dogs playing poker, you know, in the ballroom. So she had a lot of stuff there. As a matter of fact, some rooms were given over just for apparently holding stuff that was actually never used, never displayed. I guess in today's terms, we would call this hoarding. So it's interesting to speculate upon what the house was or contained that was necessarily in the physical manifestation of what was Sarah's mind. And I don't know. I don't know what was her thing. It's just that the house is such a, I think, a great metaphor for when I look at my own self and see how I construct it and furnish it and go to great lengths to constantly build and remodel and how many resources I keep throwing at that project and how entrapping that is, that I see that as a good metaphor. So it's interesting to suspect that perhaps she may have been aware of this. The only hint that maybe she was aware that this may have been the case for her is that in the ballroom, this massive ballroom, the size of a stadium, which incidentally was, in all 36 years, was never used to host a ball, there was two stained glass windows that were inscribed with lines out of Shakespeare. One that said, "Wide clasp the table of their thoughts." And the other one said, "The same thoughts people this little world." I thought that was kind of sad. I don't know what it meant to Sarah. We'll probably never know that. But for those of you who are Shakespeare geeks out there, you can ponder that. After Sarah's death, the house and its contents fell to a niece who kept what she wanted and auctioned off the rest. And it took movers 8 truckloads a day for 6.5 weeks to empty the house of its furnishings. So a lot of stuff in that house. So perhaps you could have some empathy with Sarah Winchester next time you're on a cushion during a retreat, or when you're thinking, like, wow, I have a lot of stuff to work with. So be gentle with yourself. It's enough just to see it. So in the course of my life, I have built, remodeled, continued to build my own personal mansion of self that certainly could rival the house of Sarah Winchester or the Villa de Medici or Buckingham Palace or the Hearst Castle. I don't know what it is about the California coast that seems to attract these like gigantic, massive houses filled with stuff. However, I'm beginning to realize that this incessant house building, this remodeling, this furnishing may not necessarily be in my best interest, or in the best interest of the people around me or the environment. Matter of fact, imagine this magnified by 7-8 billion people on this planet, the consequences that might have. So I'm beginning to understand what Nietzsche might have been hinting at when he kind of wryly quipped, when one has finished building one's house, one suddenly realizes that in the process one has learned something that one really needed to know in the worst way before one began. So I kind of think about that. Or in a fit of mindfulness of what I'm doing, it's perhaps something more akin to the sudden realization of Wile E. Coyote. Those of you who watched Looney Tunes as he's chasing the Roadrunner. Good metaphor for the chasing of happiness, the chasing of permanence, the chasing of, you can fill in the blank. You know, he runs off a cliff and he's like several steps off the cliff before he realizes what he's doing. Or he's created some elaborate trap with boulders to crush the Roadrunner, and it doesn't work. So he's standing underneath this pile of boulders with a stick trying to dislodge the stuck boulder. And right before it falls, he holds up a little sign. What on earth am I doing? Doesn't it feel like that? You know. So the issue really is not so much whether we have a self. Like I mentioned before, it seems to be hardwired into us. It seems that consciousness, human consciousness, creates a self. That I don't think is the problem. I don't think that's what the Buddha is saying is the problem. The problem is what we make of it and how much of our life's resources go into the building and constant remodeling and constant furnishing of the self and how attached we get to it. It's said that the study of Buddhism is the study of the self. Dogen said that. So, to see the house, to see its builder. Meditation is a way of giving ourselves the opportunity to perhaps sometimes catch a glimpse of this house we're building. More importantly, catch a glimpse of the builder. And I think sometimes that can happen in spontaneous, more tangible ways where we suddenly see what we're doing. Hopefully not in as dramatic a way as the coyote standing under a stack of boulders, but we can see what we're doing in the building of this house of self. Now, for some people, it comes as a moment of insight, perhaps a change in life. A near-death experience can have a person see things with greater clarity in terms of what they're doing with the sense of self, this house of self. Kind of like Woody Allen, having a near-death experience and saying that my whole life flashed in front of my eyes. The scary thing was I wasn't in it. Something kind of Buddhist about that. I mean, one would wonder what it'd be like to have that realization before, a near-death experience. I had an opportunity to kind of experience this kind of glimpse of the metaphoric house and house builder with an actual house, another actual house. This was my own house. Several years ago, Nancy and I decided to sell our house and downsize. And we were very fortunate to sell the house when we did, and especially fortunate in some ways that the buyer of the house wanted to buy the house completely furnished. Everything that we had in the house, she purchased, right down to the mattresses on the bed. So we kind of walked out with just boxes of clothes, basically. We sold a lot of other stuff in this massive garage sale during the Uptown Art Fair. And it was very liberating to kind of just walk away from it all, in a way. Probably the closest I'll ever come to some sort of literal, physical home leaving, in a way. But the interesting part of the story happened much later. And this was just a few months ago, where the house was again for sale. And they had an open house. So I thought, oh, I'm going to go have a walk through my old house. So I show up there, and I don't give any hint that I ever owned the place. The realtor didn't know that. So I was just kind of walking through, and it was a very strange feeling to walk through a house that I had lived in but was furnished with all my old stuff. I mean, I felt like I was haunting my own house. It was very weird. And it was it had some sort of effect on me. Thinking like, looking at all the stuff that seemed at one point to be so important, kind of defined, our life at a certain time. The house was all filled with memories. Oh, I remember that. I remember that, And now, it wasn't mine anymore. And I didn't really feel much attachment to it. I didn't feel like a sense of loss per se. I just felt like a kind of being one step to remove kind of gave me a perspective on this, thinking like, wow, you know, I can step back from all this. You know, and I consider how much time and energy and money and all kinds of resources went into furnishing this house. And I kind of thought, gosh, do I really want to do that again? Do I want to keep doing that? So it was an interesting experience. So how much house do we really need? How much self do we really need? Do we really need a grand estate filled with hordes of stuff that we don't really need? Or will a grass hut suffice? How much time, energy, and resources are we spending on this project? Is it worth it? Socrates had said, the unexamined life is not worth living. So is the life that we're creating for ourselves worth the cost of the house that we build to contain it? This is a good question to ask ourselves, I think. It's a very Buddhist question, especially in consideration of the simple fact that the metaphoric house, just like the actual house you live in, is built of stuff that eventually will just fall apart, will fall away. It changes. Everything changes. It doesn't matter whether your house is of brick, you know, wood, or grass. It all changes. Eventually crumbles, passes away, along with all the furnishings, along with the inhabitant. Everything changes. So how well will we do with that when things change in terms of our metaphoric house of self? How will we deal with change and impermanence if we are so imprisoned by the house of self we create? In 1906, there was a massive earthquake in San Francisco, which is not that far away from San Jose, and it severely damaged the Winchester house. Sarah was still alive at that time and living in the house, and she was trapped in her house for several hours as her servants and the construction workers, who never left, were there trying to get her out of her room. So in the same way, metaphorically, it seems like, you know, the bigger and more elaborate the house, the more likely perhaps we are to become entrapped by it when there's a sudden change, a sudden shift in our life, a sudden crisis. So it's something to think about, perhaps, before we do too much more building. So taking a cue from Wile E. Coyote, we can ask ourselves once in a while, what on earth am I doing? Preferably before walking off a cliff, right? Preferably, it'd be nice to find out what Nietzsche was hinting at before the 50 millionth trip to Home Depot. You know, can we take a good look at how we have a self, how we are using a self, how attached we are to a self, and kind of lighten things up, free ourselves from that before it becomes a problem? The Buddha, upon his enlightenment, is reported to have said, house builder, you have been seen. You will build this house not again. I think it's a statement of liberation. The Buddha did not need to destroy the house. There's no mention of him saying he destroys the house. He doesn't kill the builder of the house. All he does is he sees the house for what it is. He sees the builder, and that's enough to dissolve the spell and provide liberation. So, can we see this house of self that we're building for ourselves? Can we see what kind of house? Can we see the building, its furnishings, the builder? You know, can we see that and hold it lightly? Can we recognize that this all changes? You know, perhaps in so doing, that makes it easier to leave home. We're already leaving home anyway. So perhaps seeing the house, its furnishings, the building for what it is, you know, it really makes it easier to mindfully, consciously, voluntarily leave home. So can we occasionally at least step back from the work table strewn with blueprints and catalogs? We put down the tools and occasionally just open the door and walk into the world. I think that's what Buddhist teaching is an invitation to do. So that's my shortened talk on house building. So I think I'll throw things open for questions or comments. If anyone has anything they'd like to share about their own particular house or house building project. I think it's the state of California. Yeah.
They charge admission.
They do. Yeah. Yeah. It's a
lot of upkeep.
Yeah, no kidding. They have to have a special crew of people to be able to go in there and find people who are lost in it, because they have a rescue team standing by. Yes.
Would you get the Shakespeare quotes again, particularly that first one?
Oh, sure. Let's see. It's a wide clasp, the table of their thoughts.
Wide
clasp.
Wide clasp.
The table of their thoughts. Yeah. And the second one is the same thoughts people this little world. So the first one's from Troilus and Cressida, and the second one's from Richard II, in case you're interested. Yeah.
I'm just kind of amazed that this was the talk today, because we were closing on a house on Thursday.
Oh.
And it didn't work, and so now it's going to be Friday. So there is this window where we could be like, forget it, walk away.
Yeah,
but we have been making the whole thing from looking for it and like really conscious and becoming really aware of how it is a metaphor, and reading a lot about like what a house stands for in Chinese and Japanese philosophy. And it does, it makes sense. Like, you know, the body is an illusion, the house is just another, I mean, it doesn't have to be an illusion, but it's just another, it's all a metaphor, the thought, ourself, the house.
Yeah.
And just trying to keep it in line with the earth is the whole, that's what we're aiming for.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's like I mentioned, I think just like in the physical reality, we need a shelter, we need a house, and we also need a self. You've heard Tim say that many times, that Buddhism is not about subjugating or destroying or punishing the self or the ego. We tend to look at those things sometimes as if they're bad things in and of themselves, and they're not. This is part of who we are. I don't think it's possible for us to exist without a self, at least not to exist as individuals. We have a self. The question is really more of how we make use of that self. How much are we entrapped by the illusion of what a self is? And how much time, energy, and resources are we emptying into maintaining something that really is very ephemeral, constantly changing, and never really separate from the rest of life? So, you know, you could ask yourself, do you need the big Winchester mansion, or are you okay with the grass hut of Chertow? You know, I built a grass hut, you know, where there's nothing of value. You know, he takes a nap, weeds grow, you know, that kind of stuff. You know? So it makes you think.
You know, okay. This is making me think about how, you know, when I was in college, the kind of places that I was willing to live in were the kind of place that made my parents just kind of put their eyes on their hands over their eyes and shake their head. And, you know, and then how as you get older, what you believe your needs to be, and you know, I won't live somewhere without a dishwasher, or I, you know, whatever it is that you have to have, all of a sudden this sort of, it accumulates, you know. It's like, I have to have this, I have to have that, we need to have a separate room for the television, and we have to, you know, all that kind of thing. And And when you're young and you're just so glad to just have your own space, it can be a really funky old stove, and you have to share it with other people, and that's okay. But over time, you know, that's like what becomes necessary. It's sort of blonde on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When we're kids, you know, we build our forts, our physical forts, out of a blanket and some books to hold it down. And, you know, it's not a big deal when it, you know, comes apart. We create imaginary worlds that we step into and out of, kind of somehow okay with that, you know. But somehow we lose that flexibility. We become entrapped by the very artifice that is, should be a tool for our survival. So it's kind of fun to experiment with that. As a side note to, you know, when Nancy and I sold our house, you know, as I said, we walked out with virtually only the clothes that belonged to us in a box. And we went to the closing of the house, which happened without a hitch for the house we were selling. But the house we were buying, the person couldn't close on it. So we had no place to go to, you know. So we went, we were able to squat, basically, in the house that we were going to buy, our condo, actually. And, but there we're sitting there with just clothes, you know, sleeping on the floor. We didn't have a bed or anything like that. And it was kind of an interesting, although not something necessarily I'd like to repeat, but it was an interesting experience in that, you know, letting go. I mean, we didn't have any choice. I had to let go of all that. But I couldn't help but muse on the fact that, you know, this is the same thing of how this whole self works, you know. And just like, you know, you realize in situations like that, you don't really need that much to be sheltered. You don't really need that much to be okay. So we don't really need that much in a self for it to do its work, you know, for it to be useful for us. Yeah, Jeff.
Like I'm sure many of us with aging parents, at a certain point you start seeing this house of the self disappear. One morning you wake up and the roof is gone, the foundation has evaporated, home rooms vanish. That's a challenge.
It is.
And it's inevitable. I mean, unless you are struck by a truck or a bus or something like that, it's the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, Buddhism is very practical, I think, in this way. It says this is the way it is. You know, wishing it were otherwise, pretending it were otherwise, isn't going to change that. You know, so is there some way that we can be okay with that, comfortable with the uncertainty of life, comfortable with the fact that everything is changing, that we're changing, the house of the self is changing? You know, that's I think, is a great deal of the practice. You know, being open to just what is, and being okay with the fact that things change, the self changes. Yeah. Any other thoughts or reflections or stories to share? Yeah, Robert.
Do you think there's a fundamental difference between having a mansion and having a grass hut, or between like being older and having all these necessities and being young and building your fort and being willing to, when you decide, being willing to let it go, but if someone else breaks it, you can have the same reaction.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's really fundamentally a difference in the metaphoric structures themselves. I think the problem lies in our attachment to them. The problem lies in our delusion that somehow this self we create is going to be a permanent refuge from the simple laws of existence. You know, so one can become just as attached to a grass hut as they can be to a mansion, in other words. You know, both can be blown down by a strong wind. You know, so I think that it doesn't so much matter. So you guys can have a self, you know. You can have the self you know, built and be as elaborate and as furnished, you know, as you want to, you know, but just not losing sight of the fact that things change. You know, this is not who we are. You know, we just have to be careful not to let our house become a prison. So, any other? Oh.
What can one do? I mean, I think sometimes, to use the house metaphor, rooms get constructed for us by other people sometimes. Like, they put things in our house that we don't always necessarily want.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure if I understand that completely, but you know, I think the things that furnish our house, you know, the furnishings, thoughts, ideas, memories, experiences, emotions, these are all part of the furnishings of the rooms in our house. And as such, they are created by our interaction with the reality around us, with others in that reality. And that, I think, is kind of part of the mix. But I don't think that's really the problem. The problem is whether we identify with them, whether we kind of latch on to them and have them define us. You know, whether it is a pleasurable or unpleasurable, you know, a positive or painful thing, if we identify ourselves with these things, I think it becomes a problem. I don't know, does that answer or address, I should say, what you're talking about? Yeah. Okay.